This is Vectis Radio. For the people, by the people.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my very special guest, Sharon Bradley. Now, regular listeners of this show will be very familiar with Sharon's voice because she's the sponsor of the show. So thank you so much, Sharon.
You're very welcome.
And Sharon and her husband, Martin Bradley, are the owner of the new Rembrandt Gallery here in Scarrett's Lane in Newport.
Hello.
So how long have you owned the gallery?
We've actually owned the gallery now for 15 years, but I worked for the previous owner for about 10 years, so I've been here rather a long time now.
And you still love it?
Oh, I do, absolutely. You just never know what's going to come through the door. You just don't know what you're going to get in for framing.
What's the most exciting thing that's come through the door?
Exciting? Oh, gosh, there's been so many wonderful things. But I think one of the most interesting things we've had to frame is actually a jacket that belonged to Ellen MacArthur, and it was from her Jules Verne challenge. Now, when the company phoned us to ask us to frame this, they said, oh, it's just a small jacket. When it arrived, it is a full sailing jacket, including flotation suit that's inside this jacket in case, obviously, anything happens. So it was absolutely huge, but it was actually worn by her on that particular array, so very, very famous jacket.
I don't think Ellen's going to be very happy that you said her jacket was absolutely huge.
Well, I don't mean huge, but I mean it was just, well, she would, because the size of these jackets, she would know that I was meaning the jacket, not her.
So when you get something like that, you're handling it and it's given over to you temporarily to kind of take great care of, doesn't that just fill you with horror?
It can sometimes, because obviously whatever we frame is very precious to whoever owns it, whether it's a treasured family photograph or the jacket or a piece of sporting memorabilia. So yes, you're literally, this item is in your care and you have to frame it to the very best of your ability. So we do everything to conservation standard and everything is turned out to the best possible way that we can do it for the customer. So yes, sometimes a bit scary.
And what's like the kind of most amusing thing that you've had to frame?
I would actually say a pair of fur men's Speedos that belonged to a particular client that were designed by Vivienne Westwood on her sex label. They were, wow, they were just leopard print and it was so funny, but we framed them.
And had they been worn by anyone?
I believe they had been worn by somebody on a photo shoot, but I can't remember the name of the actor. But the person they belong to, he is a collector of Vivienne's things, so we frame quite a lot of different items by Vivienne Westwood as well.
Okay, so you had a pair of fur leopard print or fake faux fur Speedo type swimwear. And what kind of frame, how did you begin to put a frame for them?
Because of what they were and knowing what this particular customer is like, he would have wanted something that was quite opulent. So they actually went on to quite a jazzy coloured background mount, and then they had a big gold ornate frame around them. And they actually look really cool because that's just the type of thing that they were. And they did look really good when we framed them. But obviously we had to use a slightly 3D frame just to keep the glass off of the particular item.
Yes, I wonder if he sort of unframes them sometimes and puts them on.
Oh, no, I don't know. What do I think about that?
And have you had, you know, something that's really challenging that you just, well, I just haven't got a clue where you start with this?
Well, my husband, he does a lot of different types of framing, but I think probably one of the things that he enjoys framing is sporting memorabilia. Mm-hmm. And we have boxing gloves to frame, and he enjoys framing boxing gloves and cricket bats and things like that because it really makes him think as to how to do them. So normally what he would do is use a 3D box that he would design and then choose an appropriate frame and a mount colour to go around it, because obviously being 3D items, they can't be flat framed for obvious reasons. So he then has to build a box appropriately and then house everything and then decorate it all up as well.
Fantastic. Are there certain items, you know, like leather boxing gloves that need to breathe? Is there...
What we would do is we always put a spacer within the frame. I mean, they don't need to breathe themselves, but they cannot touch the glass, because obviously if you get any atmospheric changes with any picture, we always put a barrier in, either a mount or we would put a small slip. Sometimes it's invisible within the frame, but you need to have air circulating within the frame, whatever thickness it is, just to stop any mould or anything like that creeping in.
Mm. And how do you cope with customers who bring something in? I mean, I would imagine looking around the gallery that their expectations are always met and beyond met. But do you ever get anybody that's quite tricky and that, you know, they think, oh, that's not quite how I saw it?
Yes, we do. People do bring in items, and sometimes they have a particular idea as to how they would like it framed. And then when we start to show them the variety of frames and maybe suggest things would look slightly different, it's quite interesting that people say, oh, I'd never thought of putting it in that frame or choosing that colour for it. So their perception of how they first wanted it framed quite often changes. We haven't ever had anybody say, oh, they don't like what we've done, but sometimes we're a little bit reluctant when they come in and say, oh, just do what you think, because what we think may not be to how they envisage something. But to be perfectly honest with you, most of the time we've never had anybody say, well, it's not quite how I would like it. But I think the funniest is when people, well, not the funniest, I don't mean to be rude, when people come in, and particularly if it's a lady and gentleman, and the lady particularly wants one thing and the gentleman particularly wants something else, it can go quite fraught downstairs, I tell you. In a framing shop, you've never seen it. Sometimes it nearly comes to fisticuffs. It really does. So we have to act as mediators as well, and then they normally go back to the first frame they chose anyway.
I have visions of them kind of clonking the frame over one another's head, you know, like in sort of carry-on style.
Well, people can be quite funny sometimes, and sometimes that does happen. Tensions do rise, which you wouldn't really think in a framing environment, but it does happen.
But I suppose what you're doing is you're enhancing, often, if it's like you're saying, a cherished family photo, you're enhancing something that already means the world to someone. So when they get it back, I would imagine they're thrilled.
Yes, it's also enhancing, but it's also preserving as well, because obviously a lot of things you can never replace, the special photographs, for instance. So obviously we preserve them, we frame them to conservation standard, and as you say, then the family photograph that was in the drawer can now be hung and appreciated by themselves and obviously other family members as well. So although it's very cherished and hidden in a drawer, it's also nice for them to see it on their wall. So that's obviously what we do for them.
And you're talking about it being done to conservation standard. What does that actually mean?
The materials that we use are conservation standard materials. A lot of the framing that we used comes from sustainable forests as well, because we're quite sort of eco-friendly here. Anything that I can use that is recyclable or recycled, we will do. Our mount card is 100% pH neutral, so it has no acidity in it whatsoever, so there's no way that it would damage anybody's work. We don't ever stick anybody's work down to a backing card. It's always conservation hinged. If I do cross stitch for anybody, I would always lace it, which is basically you pin the cross stitch around to an acid-free piece of card, then you literally lace it on the back with cotton so as it's stretched, and never ever stick it down with glue or spray adhesive, anything like that. When Martin does the football shirts, we use special tags that go into the shirts that can always just be snipped, so it means that the shirt can be taken off of the card and presented back to the customer as shirt form, so you never have a problem with it being stuck and not being able to be taken off of the backing card.
That's really interesting. When you I can picture what you mean by this stitching in at the back. It's like a sort of form of weaving, isn't it? Yes, with cotton at the back. Yeah,
very much so. Yeah. And we have to get the tensioning first. I mean, people have taken an awful lot of time to do these works, these tapestries, cross stitches and anything. So I think that, you know, if we can present them back to them, although they don't see all what goes on behind the frame, we pride ourselves in framing everything to the best of our abilities and to only being professional and to conservation minded as well.
Oh, that's lovely. And you're a businesswoman, and you work with your husband, so you live and work with your husband.
Yeah.
What's that like?
Can be a bit tedious at times. No. To be fair, we have a pretty good working relationship. Most of the time, Martin is on the upper floor because he's cutting all the frames and everything up there, and I'm downstairs advising customers and things. But we obviously do come together. We discuss different framings and how we're going to do things. And yes, we have disagreements sometimes, as every couple does. But then we generally go home. We talk a bit about what we've done during the day. But then we have our home life as well.
Okay, and so if tensions do get a bit fraught, how do you deal with that?
Well, I basically just tell him he's incorrect and I'm always correct, and that's how it works. So I'm really the boss, but
I like that.
No, to be fair, we do get on very well, business as well as home life. So yeah, I think you have to. If you're working with somebody and living with somebody all the time, you have to have that formal relationship. I mean, we respect each other, business minded as well, but also obviously we love each other, so we get on pretty good.
Mm-hmm. And what are the hours here? Do you have one day off, don't you, which is a Sunday, is that correct?
Sunday, yes, we have Sunday off, because then I have to do everything that everybody else does during the week, or if they're not working at home, that has to go into a Sunday. But we normally open from 9 o'clock until 5 p.m. Monday through Saturday.
Okay, and so if somebody just wanted a A4 photo framed, how long, what sort of turnaround do you offer?
Our normal turnaround time is approximately 10 days to 2 weeks. Obviously, if it's something somebody needs in a hurry, we get it done literally as quick as we can for them. I mean, we have been known to frame on the day, but we prefer not to do that if we can, because obviously we have so many clients, and we try to make everybody's work approximately 2 week turnaround. If it's the cleaning of an oil painting or something that's very involved, it then does actually take a little bit longer, but we always inform the customer of that when they bring the work into us.
Okay. And just to play devil's advocate here, what's the difference between, for you, from having something framed in a bespoke way to just popping down the high street and buying any old frame, you know, just that takes your fancy?
It's the quality, I believe, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, yes, you can buy off-the-peg ready-made frames, and I know people do that and just put the odd photograph in. There's nothing wrong with that if you want to do that, but you do not get the variety of choice of the colours of the mount card, the materials that are used, and to be honest with you, when Martin and I make frames and we produce them for the customers, they are a very high standard, and we like to take pride in what we do rather than just buying, I don't mean to be rude, a plastic frame off of the peg down in wherever.
Yeah. So do you have an arty background?
Not an arty background as such. I always have had an interest in art, but I actually come from a horsey background, so not really artistic, but I love colour and I can put things together, and I do quite a lot of textile art. So that's where my forte is, really.
Okay. And you were telling me that there's really two businesses, isn't there? There's a new Rembrandt Gallery and there's the Silver Screen.
Yes, that's right.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about Silver Screen?
Okay. The Silver Screen is in the gallery. The gallery is actually housed over two floors. And what the Silver Screen at the Rembrandt Gallery is, it's a collection of fully authenticated autographs from the world of film, music and more. Everything is beautifully presented, and it's framed obviously by ourselves, and it all comes with a certificate of authentication. And now this certificate of authentication is endorsed by AFTEL, which is the Autograph Fair Traders Association, and that was set up by Mark McClellan. I suspect people will have heard of him. He actually does all the authentication for the Channel 4 programme Posh Pawn, Prestige Pawnbrokers. So everything comes direct from Mark, fully authenticated, and then we have it here because we do not sell copies, secretarial copies, or any kind of copies at all. Everything is first-hand signatures, and that's what we pride ourselves on doing. When we first decided to do that part of the business, I didn't want anything that wasn't correct. So we know through Mark that all the signatures we have here have been fully authenticated.
That's incredible, because you have, if I might say, one hell of a collection. I mean, I'm astounded by what you have on the walls here. What's your favourite?
I don't know. I love all the 1920s and the 1930s pieces. I remember as a child watching the old movies, some of them black and white, on a Sunday afternoon, and I just dreamt to be that lady in that beautiful gown walking down those stairs. But I do have a fascination of people like Myron Alloy, Betty Grable, all the real true old actors. But I also have, I like Humphrey Bogart, and then the 50s James Dean, so a variety of people. But I think probably one of the favourite signatures that I have downstairs has to be the John Wayne piece, because again, on the television as a youngster, my father and I, we used to watch the Cowboys, and I always remember John Wayne, so to have his autograph in the gallery is really quite special to me.
I'm looking at Humphrey Bogart at the moment.
You've got Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman from Casablanca. Oh yes, it's an absolute classic film, and to have both of their signatures in one piece with a beautiful picture mount of them actually in the film, we have some stunning pieces.
You said, how have you come by all these?
Most of the pieces that we have, again, they come through Mark, so they may have been in people's private collections. Some collections consist of hundreds and hundreds of autographs and photographs. Then they have to be authenticated. Other pieces people may have put into auction, and he buys them from auction, and obviously he also purchases them from the programme itself. Then again, everything is authenticated and it comes down to us. But it's amazing the people that you meet since we've been doing this that have had ties with the film industry in one way or another. We met a gentleman who called himself the T-Boy, and he used to work at Pinewood Studios, and he met many different actors and actresses. Some of them would sign for you, some of them wouldn't give you the time of day. So it's interesting to hear a little bit about their backgrounds as well. But most pieces we have do come from private collections.
Wow. I saw Matt Lucas yesterday. No, yes, George, yes, no, not Scores on the Doors, no, Star Wars, George Lucas, yeah, there we go. Just as well I didn't ask him for his autograph, wasn't it, because I'd have just said, hello there, Matt, could I please have your autograph, thank you. Couldn't find a pen, so that just about sums me up. And but he was charming, he was signing for people. There wasn't many people, it was in Mayfair in London, but he was just being really lovely and really generous with his time and with his attitude. You know, it wasn't, he didn't give the impression of somebody who couldn't wait to get away. He was somebody who was there and on his way somewhere else, clearly, but giving these people time, which is lovely, isn't it?
It is. I mean, to think that how famous these people are, most of them really don't mind to sign autographs and things. We actually have George Lucas downstairs autograph if you'd like to go down and see it, just because you didn't get his. You can have him from the gallery. But yes, we have it in a classic Star Wars piece as well. But yes, some of them, you know, are very open to having sign autographs. Others are very, very hard to come by. I mean, we have Laurel and Hardy's autograph downstairs. Really, really hard to come by because they just hardly signed anything at all. And you would think the amount of fame that they had, the amount of pictures that they did and publicity they would have done, but they signed very little indeed. So
was that because autographs were less of a thing back then?
I don't really know if it's because they were less of a thing, because obviously when they were first starting out they were actually asked to sign an awful lot of things, but as they got more famous they actually stopped signing things, and only would sign something, maybe a legal document or if they were really pressed into signing it. And you always know if you've got a legitimate Laurel and Hardy signature, because they would never sign in the same coloured pen. Although they used to be the greatest comedy duo, they didn't always see eye to eye.
Okay, so I was going to ask you about that. How, and I'm sure it's a really lengthy process and it's a slightly different side to what you do, but this authentication process, I know it's not what you do, but you have it done for you. Do you know much about that? I mean, where on earth would you begin to know if something's genuine?
I mean, I will be perfectly honest with you, I don't know an awful lot about it, but we are learning all the time, hence why we have everything from Mark, who, as I say, set up AFTAL, which is to stamp out all the photocopying and all the frauds and things like that. Now, he is an handwriting expert, so he would know how to look for the different sort of depth of pen going onto things. If they would sign something with a swirl in the signature, he'd compare it to legal documents. We have checks that are signed downstairs and things like that as well. So you would actually have to go through so many processes to rule out the fact that it wasn't a forgery, and he obviously is the gentleman that would do that for us because he's qualified to do that.
Sure. So do you know how, when did people start signing? I mean, obviously once the movie business started, but do you know where it all began? Who was the first person to ever give an autograph?
I don't actually know that, because I mean, autographs, as I say, would have been anything that was signed. As I say, we have checks downstairs. You could have had, we have a letter, we have a beautiful letter from Joan Crawford that's actually signed at a hotel that she stayed at in London, and this was actually to one of her fans, and it's signed on the hotel's letterhead and everything.
I've seen that, it's lovely.
And so you would, they would have just signed things, signed date things, checks, as I said, legal documents, hotels, slips, a general letter. So that's how you would obtain their signatures. As I say, it's not just a case of signing a card or signing a photograph. I mean, lots of the young starlets, they would have all their publicity photographs, which we also have some of those in the gallery. They're beautiful still photographs, and they would have hundreds of these printed to basically send off to all the film producers to say, look, here I am, this is what I look like. And then obviously if they were successful in their films, then they would start to sign these postcards, sign these pictures, and they would then be kept as collections. And as and when they would be mailed out to different people and fans that would become fans of the picture, or to different agents and things like that. So that's how these things started to get into collections, because they were actually bought up by people that would appreciate the film at the time, or that particular actor or actress.
And do you think people, you know, would hang around sort of stage doors and film sets to try and get these autographs? Do you think initially they did it because they just were in love with those stars and admired their work, or do you think it was always for some sort of monetary gain?
No, I don't think so. I think it was because they were in love with the stars themselves. I mean, they did use it even in the sort of the 30s and the 40s. They would have signing days where you could actually go to the studios, Pinewood, or if you're in America, the different American studios, and they would actually come out of the doors and they would actually sign for you. People would queue for hours, just as they do today, to get a glimpse of that particular star. I mean, especially Marilyn Monroe. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the actors and actresses were followed about an awful lot, even in those days. Possibly more for sort of paparazzi type motives than to get autographs. But again, if they were in a restaurant, sometimes they were hounded to get autographs. Or if you were just outside and you spoke to them, they would quite happily give you an autograph. So I think it really was for the love of the actor or the actress, not for monetary gain. Obviously, there is monetary gain in it, because people do buy certain signatures and then they try and sell them on and things like that. But normally it would be for a collector.
I got Paul McCartney's autograph. I used to work in Soho Square, and that's where one of his offices was. And it was his birthday, and some fans had brought him a cake, and he came out and very graciously accepted the cake and blew out the candle and signed for the few of us that were out there. I've lost it, Sharon. I've lost that autograph.
Well, don't worry, because we have one downstairs.
I knew you were going to say that.
Sorry, yes, we did. I mean, to be fair, Paul did used to sign quite a lot, and obviously he still does. And he always is very accommodating. So, yes, but that's really silly to have lost it.
I know. I've also lost David Essex's, not quite in the same category as Paul McCartney, but I had that, and I've lost that too.
Oh, no. See, these are things you really need to look after.
I know.
Not just because they're worth a lot of money, but that's a little piece of that person you've got there. They've actually signed that, so that's actually their hand on something.
I know, but I think they might have, somebody might have purloined them from
really?
Me. Yes. I think I probably told far too many people that I had it and where it was and showed them. And then in various house moves, they've kind of, yes, so just slightly
but
been
just
been repossessed, let's just say. So whose autograph, not in terms of, you know, your business, but just you personally, would you love to have?
Oh, gosh, that's a very hard one. I mean, although we have had it and we have now sold it, I'm afraid I do love Marilyn Monroe. And we've had one of her signatures, but it was completely out of my price range, to be perfectly honest with you. But I really would love to have had an early Marilyn Monroe signature.
So how much would Marilyn's signature go for?
Marilyn's signature was approximately $1,500 to $1,800,000.
$1,500, but that's not, you know, for somebody that loves her, that's, you know, could be affordable, I suppose. Not out of range.
No, I mean, some of the signatures we have here, they start as little as maybe £70-80, and then they do go up to sort of £1,500, £1,800, £2,000. I mean, we have Michael Jackson in the window at the moment, which I'm actually raving about, because we've got Michael Jackson's signature, and it's in this beautiful presentation piece with gorgeous pictures from the different albums that he's done. And I mean, that's sort of £1,500, but you're never going to get that signature again. And for a real fan, I mean, wow, what a coup to have his signature.
Yeah, what a beautiful thing. I know somebody's got his Fedora.
Gosh, how lucky. Very lucky indeed.
Yeah, lovely. But do you find there's a huge market for it here on the island?
I mean, I think we're growing. A lot of people, to be honest with you, still don't know we're here. So now you do know we're here. Please come and see us. We have autographs, as I say, from film, music and more. We have Buzz Aldrin's signature downstairs as well.
Now, Buzz was the first man on the moon.
He was the first man on the moon, mm-hmm. And he was on the Apollo 13. So we have that. We have from that.
Did he sign it when he was on the moon?
Well, that I don't know.
Did he find a pen, unlike me, floating about?
He may have taken a pen with him to just recite some things. I don't know. But we have sort of his signature, and then we have like Harry Potter. We have people from film, from television, all sorts of signatures. You have to come see all the signatures and how they're presented as well.
And just for those people who may not know, because it's a little bit hidden away, where is Scarrett's Lane in Newport?
Okay, Scarrett's Lane in Newport is actually behind Pyle Street. So if you come in from the bottom area, we are on the lane that's adjacent to McDonald's. And then we have Chapel Street car park at the other end of us. So there's lots of easy parking. And you can just walk through from where BHS used to be through Grace Walk, and then you're into Scarrett's Lane. And we're up there on the left-hand side. Beautiful gold-looking shop.
So you're actually incredibly central, aren't you? Probably right in the middle of Newport, really.
We are. Yes, we are. Yes. I mean, we're not that far off of the beaten track. And we're, as I say, car park at the top of the lane. And then you're straight out onto the high street as well.
Super. So we'll be talking to Sharon, not just about pictures and framing and famous people's autographs, but also about her other passion. More of this after the break. Thank you very much for listening.
Stay social and get in touch. Give us a call on 01983 240 666, or add us on Skype. It's vectis.radio. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
Hello and welcome back to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my very special guest, Sharon Bradley, part owner of the new Rembrandt Gallery with her husband, Martin. And that's right here in the heart of Newport in Scarrett's Lane. So if you haven't been, please come down, because I was quite literally blown away by the wonderful collection of memorabilia here, sort of Hollywood memorabilia. So there's autographs, there's photographs, and they're stunning. And the best thing about them all, they're all completely authenticated. They're all real. There's not a fake or a false one in sight, is there, Sean?
No, there's not. As you say, they are completely authenticated, all genuine signatures.
And how many have you got here now?
Oh, gosh. I mean, we must have upwards of at least 80 signatures, but that changes every day because obviously we sell them as well every day. So they do change. But we have, once new ones come in, we have at least 80 here at any one time.
So you must get some really good stories when people come in to buy, because it's a big purchase, isn't it? And quite an emotional purchase, I should think.
Yes, it is, very much so. And I think one of the nicest ones that we had was probably about 3 weeks ago. And a gentleman came in and he actually purchased the Winston Churchill signature. It was in a beautiful photographic mound with his signature and obviously a plaque explaining where it was signed, etc., etc. And this gentleman is a huge Winston Churchill fan, and he won't mind me saying it actually brought a tear to his eye because he'd been after a signature for so many years, and to actually own something that his idol, for a better word, had actually signed, and such a great man himself, he was literally blown away, and he sent us a photograph the next day to show us where he'd put it, pride of place in the front room with his other Winston Churchill memorabilia. So yes, to see the emotion in that gentleman was quite something.
Oh, that's a lovely story. And just looking around at them all, you've got some beautiful photos as well, and you've even got a checks, and you've got the signatures. So who put them all together as a piece?
What happens is my husband does all of the framing, and some of the photographic mounts, they're actually cut for us in London because we don't have laser photo mount facilities here. But Martin puts everything together, and we put all the colours together and things like that as well, and then we choose what's going to go on them appropriately. I mean, we have one downstairs of Freddie Mercury, and we undenied as to what to put on there, and then Martin and I both decided it had to be an opulent gold frame because that was just Freddie's character.
Absolutely, yeah, that's lovely. And what's the most fun you've had with one of the signatures?
I don't know, because they're all so different. I mean, I've liked doing things like the Mary Poppins, and we've had lots of different ones come into frame as well, some very nice little black and white ones, and then we've had things like Lauren and Hardy come into frame. So there's just so many different ones to frame, so all of them have been good fun, really.
And then you choose the photos to go with them, is that how it works?
What happens is sometimes if they're signed on a photograph, obviously that's the photograph that they're signed on, and it comes down with it, and then other times we put appropriate photographs together with the autographs as well. I mean, we have our partner Dean, who's got Star Signings, which is opposite Morrison's. He deals mostly with sporting memorabilia down there, but sometimes he may have a photograph down there that would be appropriate to go with a piece of memorabilia and a signature, so we include that in it for him as well.
Brilliant. And all his stuff is authenticated as well, isn't it?
Yeah, all Dean's stuff is also fully authenticated, and it all comes from Mark as well, so it's all AFTAL, and everything he has down there is authenticated, and whether it be sort of a football piece or a boxing piece, the same applies to him. It's all authenticated autographs.
Okay. And it's not all old black and white movies. I mean, I love them, but there's stuff here called Quadrophenia, there's Enter the Dragon, Bruce Lee, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre even, Clint Eastwood, there's all sorts of The Omen too. There's all sorts of stuff. And you've got film posters as well, haven't you?
Yeah, this is what it is. The other side of the silver screen, we also have a huge collection of original cinema posters. These are all quads, and they've all come from cinemas, either in London or even here on the Isle of Wight. We have a small collection of cinema posters that were from the Queen's Cinema, which I believe, I'm probably going to get this wrong, but was in Ryde. And we have Herbie, Rides Again, from one extent. And then some of the ones, as you say, in London, we have Psychic Killer, Near Dark, Omen, etc., etc. But these are all original cinema posters, so again, there's no photocopies or reprints.
Wonderful. So how much, for example, is the Omen 2?
I mean, the Omen 2 is about £160 framed as it is, with its nice black frame.
Well, it would have to be black, wouldn't it?
Oh, of course.
But you see, if I had the Omen on my wall, I'd worry that would come down, the glass would sort of shatter on my head with that. It's not something I'd want over my bed, put it that way. But no, I mean, they're just beautiful pieces. And you've got The Sound of Music. Lovely.
You know, everybody loves a bit of Julie Andrews. You can't beat her. So we also have a Sound of Music original poster. And then to the left of that, we have a fully authenticated Julie Andrews signature from Mary Poppins.
Just fantastic. I love them all. And I really do urge people to come down and just browse round and have a look and just see, because something is bound to take your fancy, and it brings back so many lovely memories, and there's the films that you loved as a kid, and there's something for everyone here, isn't there? I love your collection of black and white starlets.
Thank you. Yes, that's my passion. 1920s, 1930s, and these are all original movie stills, which they would have used as publicity pieces when they were literally sort of auditioning for films. They would have sent these out to the different movie companies, the producers, etc. And to be fair, they are all very glamorous.
So if you could have been, you know, if you could have been the shoes of one of those girls, who would it have been?
Oh, now that's really hard, because they're all very beautiful and all very elegant. But I do particularly like Myrna Loy, I have to say, sort of especially in the 1920s, the actresses of that time. But she just had such a sophistication about her and an elegance that I just don't think you can copy today.
And do you have any of these at home? Do you just kind of get them in and think, oh, I can't sell that, I've got to keep it, I want it and I'm having it?
Maybe that's a question you should ask Martin. No, our kitchen is absolutely full of them. We have an older property, and I have a 1920s kitchen, and to be fair, I have lots of postcards and original movie stills from the 1920s with the ladies. I do have gentlemen in there as well. We have double aperture pictures with the lady one side and the gentleman the other side. So when I'm doing mundane things like the cooking and the washing, I can actually look at them and think, oh, no, I'm actually just in some film set.
And what sort of film would you have liked to have been in? Are you a sort of Doris Day girl or a screwball comedy? Where would you put yourself?
Martin would definitely say screwball comedy. He wouldn't say Doris Day. So, yeah, no, screwball comedy or no, maybe a nice romance sometimes, you know, like be transported back into the days when men were very chivalrous and things like that. Not saying they're not today, but, you know, true romantics.
Yeah, I mean, and looking around, they do transport you to another time and another place and just take you out of yourself, don't they? They're beautiful things to have and to own. And changing the subject, you have got a very unusual hobby that has got nothing to do with the movies, got nothing to do with art or picture framing. Tell us what it is, Sharon.
We race Siberian Huskies. We have 13 Siberian Huskies at home and a Dalmatian. We race competitively all over the country during the winter time. We race sort of start down in the south, all through the country up to Scotland, where hopefully we get some snow to race on. And then last year, Martin actually competed in Germany with one of our dogs as well. So that's what we do when we're not here.
You say that like it's just going shopping or something. I mean, that's incredible. So you've got 14 dogs.
Yep.
And one of them is a Dalmatian.
She is.
And the rest are Siberian Huskies. What kind of size do these dogs grow to?
I mean, they're not huge, to be fair. A lot of people think that because they're Siberian Huskies, they're very large. I mean, they're probably just over my knee height, sort of, you know, their bodies, and then their heads are obviously a little bit higher. 22 inches is normally sort of standard fitting Siberian Husky size. The Dalmatian is slightly bigger. We've probably had them now for the past 12, 13 years. We've been involved with them and the sport. And as I say, we race, but we also show at championship level as well.
And how much would they weigh?
They weigh, I see again, a lot of coats, so people think they're rather heavy, but we always have ours so that they're slightly leaner and well-muscled for racing. So they average between 19 to 25 kilos, something like that.
And how long is their racing life? Is it longer than an actual greyhound?
We normally start to train ours when they get to about 8 months to a year old, because we don't believe in training them too early, because obviously their growth plates are still moving, their muscles are still developing. And then they can quite happily, unless they get an injury, go on running until they're sort of 12, 13, 14 years old. Obviously, some of them, we have one at home who she just goes for walks on the lead now, because one day she just decided, I'm not going to run anymore, I don't want to do this. So that's fine, that's what she decided. So now she just enjoys going for walks on the wander lead. But generally, up to sort of 13, 14. So we have different classes, and we have what's called a veteran class. And although 7 doesn't sound very old, and you don't have to race in this veteran class at 7, when the dog gets to 7 years old, they do a slightly shorter distance course. So the dog still goes out and enjoys itself, doesn't realise it's doing a shorter distance, but obviously is still competitive in what it does.
So what is the average distance then?
Our average distance is about sort of 3.5 to 4 miles. The beginning of the season, we start off 2 to 2.5 miles, and by the end of the season, we normally get up to about 5 or 6 miles. We like to train our dogs slightly further than that, because obviously then when you're in a race situation, they've got that extra little bit to give when they're doing a slightly shorter distance.
And what speeds do they manage?
Speeds, Martin Ford dog team, bearing in mind they're pulling a rig, which is like a three-wheel trike, and then it has Martin on it as well, unless we're going uphill or along the flat, which obviously he gets off to run. Average speed, sort of maybe 18, 20 miles an hour. Top end, sort of 22, 24 miles an hour in some cases.
Gosh. So you said Martin hops off and runs alongside, did you? Did I understand that correctly?
No, what happens is the dogs are harnessed, so they're in front. Then they have lines that go back to the rig, and then they have a bungee, which obviously takes up any pressure so they don't get any injuries to their spine, etc. And then that is then attached to the rig, and then either Martin or myself literally are on the rig when you're just going along or going downhill. But when they're going uphill or on the flat, you get off, and you run basically between the foot plates. So you're behind the dog, but within the rig at all times. I mean, I don't think I'd kind of like to try and get off and try and run to the side, because I think I'd fall flat on my face. So you stay behind the rig at all times, but most of the time you are actually on. And obviously when you're going around the corners downhill, everything can get very exciting, because the back wheels go out and you slide all over the place. So it's a very, very adrenaline run sport for the dogs and for ourselves.
Yeah, so you must be super fit as well.
Probably not as fit as I should be. I do run, to be perfectly honest with you. I run and I do a bit of exercise, and Martin is a very keen cyclist, so he cycles a lot as well to keep the fitness up, because our dogs are in their height of fitness, we have to be at a height of fitness as well. So it is a very hard regime in the winter for training and racing as well. They're in the highest of condition and fitness that they can be. And then when I look at that cream cake and I look at that salad, I think, oh gosh, I don't know which one. And then I think, no, the dogs come first, so go for the salad.
What would the dogs choose?
The dogs would choose... probably the cream cake if they had the choice, but they don't get, they actually get fed. We feed our dogs on a raw diet, and they obviously get bonio and biscuit and things like that as well.
Okay, so do you regard them as pets, or do you regard them as sort of working dogs?
Okay, first and foremost, they are all our pets. They are of a working type breed, so they do need to work. But they also enjoy sofa time, telly time, and although they're a breed that enjoys the coldest of weathers, they also vie to get in front of our open fire. We've been out training in sort of -2. They've absolutely flown, and then they get back, Martin lights the fire, and then literally all hell breaks loose, because one tries to get in, then the other one tries to get in. So they do appreciate their home comfort. So yes, first and foremost, they're our pets, but we also have them and we enjoy them for what they're bred to do.
And do you have 14 dogs in your house?
Not at once. A lot of them do live indoors, but we also, Martin built a purpose-built dog room that's adjacent to our house, so they live out there as well. And we've also got a large garden, to be fair, that is fenced with 6-foot fencing, so the dogs get a free run in the garden as well, and we have got kennels and things. But we're very lucky, because Martin's parents go up at least once a day, and we always go home once a day to check our dogs, so we have CCTV as well.
So this is the equivalent of a granny flat for dogs, in essence?
Possibly. I mean, people say maybe they're a little bit too well looked after, because they have things like, all the floors are tiled, they're all double glazed, they have blinds, they have a radio, they have telly, then it's all controlled by remote, so maybe, yeah.
Do they control it by remote?
No, we have to do that, but they're very clever. But I mean, they do live at nice. Well, we try to provide for them the best we can.
I used to work for Dogs Trust, you know, the charity, and they had a home for older dogs, and it was a lovely detached house. And like you say, they used to put the TV on for them and the radio, and they had sofas. And this is where these older dogs could have lived out their days, because people were less inclined to adopt them because they were elderly, and perhaps they had, you know, bad hips, arthritic hips. But they had kind of the life of Riley, which was lovely, because obviously perhaps they hadn't had the best of lives early on, but it was really nice that they had this lovely old home to go to. But obviously yours is all mod cons.
Mod cons in some respects, but also we sit at home and we try, for the hour that we try to watch television, if you can picture the scene, we have a 3-seater sofa and the dogs are laid across the back of the sofa, they're laid on the arms like sphinxes, they're laid on the seat. Martin perches on the edge of his chair and I perch on the edge of the sofa. We look at each other and say, well, move a dog, and then you look at the dog and think, oh, they look so comfy, how can you move them? So yes, we sit on the edge, they have all the sofa and everything else.
And you know all their names, and you can tell the difference between them all?
Yeah, very much so. Although some of them do look very similar, and to the outsider, they think, oh gosh, how do you tell the difference between them? They've all got such individual characters and personalities. And yes, sometimes when they're all coming at once, I do call the wrong dog's name, and the one that I do want standing out there going, looking at me, thinking, well, why are you calling that dog? You want me, don't you? So yes, sometimes it can get a little confusing, but no, we do know who everybody is.
So who's the top dog?
The top dog is actually our eldest dog, who is Tarn. Now, he'll be 16 in March, so he's an old boy, but he's still in charge of everybody. He has retired from racing now, but he still puts the youngsters very much in their place if he has to. Not nastily, but he'll just give them a bit of a nudge or a little bit of a lip curl, and they'll think, oh, okay, let's back away, Tarn's about.
I've got a friend, she's got a dog, and she refers to herself as the alpha dog, and she says this dog has to know who is boss, in the nicest possible way. Do you or Martin feel that you are the alpha dog?
I mean, yes, to be honest with you, it's a hard place to be, but yes, we do have to be in charge of the dogs, to be perfectly honest with you. We possibly let them get away with a little bit too much, but first and foremost, we have to know that we have to be in charge of that pack, because they do live as a pack most of the time. There's a pack hierarchy amongst them, and then yes, we do have to know that we are sort of in charge of them. But it's nothing forceful or anything like that. I mean, they look up to us, and we love them very, very much, and it wouldn't be without any of them. But there does have to be this sort of like, no, I actually want you to do that, please, and you will do as you're told. Most of the time.
So do they ever get kind of vicious with one another, or get competitive and it all sort of spills out?
They don't get vicious with one another. We have a lot of girls, so unfortunately when it is season times, I won't tell fibs, they do niggle each other, but it's more of a wind-up than anything else. We call it handbags at dawn. We're very lucky that our dogs don't get aggressive with each other, but again, that's something we wouldn't stand for. I don't stand for any aggression within the dogs. They play fight, and anybody coming in will probably think, gosh, that's a bit hard, but they fight, they play fight very hard, but there's never any malice between them. And if somebody gets too much, they'll get a quick, and that's the end of it. Sort of thing, let's go away and let's not carry on doing this. And sometimes when it gets all a bit much in the house and I'm thinking, gosh, there goes my ornaments, I do have to do a timeout, and they're like, oh, she's told us, we're going to sit down now.
And is that something you've trained them in as well, that discipline?
Training them in the discipline, basically, we have to be in charge of them, but they do push us sometimes, as they do push each other. But again, it's something that we do it through love and positive training and reward. We're not aggressive with the dogs in any way. Sometimes, like everything, they get a bit much for me. Sometimes when they're all sort of like going mad in the house, and I'll be like, oh, and the moment I do that, basically they put the V's up to me and go, yeah, we're listening to you. Mm-hmm. But if you use a calm, assertive voice, then they're like, oh, okay, she means business then.
Okay. It's a bit like having a classroom of children, I imagine.
Well, they say, obviously, like with the dogs, they're comparable to children in the fact that they will vie for your attention. They will play one off against another one. The youngsters that are in our pack, they will wind the slightly older dogs up. And if they get sort of like told off, sort of like, oh, don't do that by the other dog, it'll be, well, it wasn't me, it was him. And they'll actually, we've actually watched, they'll push a dog forward to go, well, that was the one that did it, and think, ha ha, you just got done, I didn't.
And what's their idea? Do you take them down onto the beach? What's their idea of a really good day out and a treat?
A good day out for them is obviously training and racing. That's what they're born to do, that's what they're bred to do, and that's what they enjoy the most. I cannot move a racing harness in the house with all out heck breaking loose. I have to put them in pillowcases when it's time to wash them, because if they see a harness or they see their collars from being laid down nice and calm, they'll all of a sudden get up and it will be hype. It literally will be hysteria. They will be screaming and howling and jumping to literally get on and do what they want to do. But also we have a field that belongs to some friends of ours, and they very kindly let us use that, and we've borrowed some money, to be fair, from Martin's mum and dad to fence it. So we've fenced that all with 6-foot fencing, and we take our dogs there, and it's an area that we can free run them in, and we know they are perfectly safe. And it's just purely on their behalf, they've asked just for us to be able to use it, so we go there and our dogs are safe.
Fantastic. And what about things like grooming 14 dogs? Where does that begin and end?
Grooming 14 dogs. I do it in batches, to be honest with you, because we also show. We show at championship level, and I'm lucky enough to have champions in the breed as well. And to be fair, they do very well in their showing. But I always take maybe 2 or 3 to the show, so they get bathed and groomed. But everybody gets a brush at least once a week, because obviously you have to just be in, you know, check their coats and check them. And it also gives you bonding time with that particular dog. But they molt basically typically twice a year, and when they molt, they molt, they shed their coats completely, and it's very therapeutic because you can just stand there and you can basically tuft the hair out of them. And with the funny seasons that we have, sometimes we can have dogs molting for 12 months a year, different dog, but throughout the whole 12-month cycle.
That's fun.
Yes, Henry Hoover thinks it's fun, yeah. Hoover every day, and it's just like tumbleweed coming down the garden. But in the wintertime, the birds like it because we keep it and we put it up in the trees for their nests.
That's fantastic. And what about bath time?
Bath time's fun. They don't get bathed in the house. We have a hot tap outside, and all their shampoo facilities are outside. So they get bathed, and we don't bath them too much because I like to keep a little bit of oil in their coat. So they basically get bathed if they're in an absolute muddy state. They get bathed, or sometimes they don't because they have a self-cleaning coat, or if they're going to a show, obviously I bath and groom them for the show.
And how do they travel when you take them to a show?
We have our van, and it's a purpose-built van, and they all have their own cages and their beds within the van. Some of them go in twos and some of them go in threes, but they're all appropriate size for the dogs, with plenty of space to turn around and stand up. But they know as soon as we say van that they're going somewhere, they get all excited, they jump in their bed, they curl down, and that's them for the journey.
Fantastic. And have you had them from pups?
Some of them we've had from pups. Some of them have been rehomed dogs or rescue dogs. And others we actually bred a litter 3 years ago, so we have our own pups as well.
Gosh, so is that something you want to get into more? Or I imagine that's just another layer, isn't it, breeding them?
Breeding is a very complicated subject, shall I say. We purely bred from our dogs to further our own race teams and our lines. I would never breed, I'm sorry, for the pet market or for commercial value. The puppies that we didn't keep, they've all gone to friends, they've gone to working homes, and I hear about them, honestly, nearly every other day. We get to see them when we go to races, and that's the only reason we bred was to further our own racing lines.
Okay, now if somebody wanted to go and watch one of these races, is it a spectator sport?
You can go and watch, and it's very exciting and exhilarating. The nearest race to us we have is in the New Forest, and then literally they're throughout the country up to Scotland. We belong to the Siberian Husky Club of Great Britain. We also belong to AMWAR, which is the Alaskan Malamute Working Association. Although we have Siberian Huskies, they cater for us as well at their races. And if you look on the internet for Siberian Husky races, it will give you locations and organisations that we'll be putting them on. So with the spectators, all that we ask, please, is if you take a dog, please, please make sure it's on the lead and kept well back off of the trail. And there's normally special spectator areas to go and stand.
So why has this never been televised?
I think it has been televised a little bit. Normally sort of John Craven and the Newsround and people like that used to go out to Aviemore, and they would televise it when it was up in Aviemore, because that's basically the biggest event of our calendar. We take over the whole of Aviemore village, and the race circuit is actually around the cross-country ski slope at Glenmore, so we race all around there, and that is huge public. There's so many people there, it's unbelievable. They line the roads and they're all the way around the course. It's such a big spectacle.
And are you shouting at the dogs in the way that a shepherd would shout at a sheepdog, like one man and his dog when they do that whistling? Yeah. Do you have the equivalent of that?
We have commands for our dogs, but basically the dogs themselves are so G'd up at the start to do it, they want to get on so that they go anyway. But then you would just say things like pick it up or come on or whatever specific words you have to your dogs to encourage the dogs to race a little bit faster or go a bit faster. When we get to specific turns, we have commands for turns. Sometimes they listen, sometimes they don't.
So what's the command for turn?
If you're going to turn right, it's G, and if you're going to turn left, it's ho. So it's ho and G, and on by obviously speaks for itself, and whoa, stop, that speaks for itself as well.
So it's a bit like horse, a bit like horses.
It is a little bit like, right, yeah, it's just like riding and giving your commands. Normally, obviously, with the horses, your legs are your commands and your aids, but your voice is your command with your dogs.
Brilliant. And do you think they work as a team?
Yes, they do, generally. I mean, normally you would always have a lead dog. We've got two or three dogs that we would put in lead on different teams. We race teams of sort of from 2 to 4 to 6. And also you can race one or two dogs on the bike, which is called the bike cure class, which is very good, especially for youngsters, to take them out one to one. They run in front of the bike, attached by a line and a bungee to the bike. And it's good for command training because they're literally at one with you then, and they're not sort of listening or watching what the other dogs in the team may be doing. But saying that, also putting a youngster on with a very experienced dog on a team, they will learn from that dog which way that dog's turning as we ask them to do so.
And when you win, are the dogs aware that they've won?
They think they've won every race. to be perfectly honest with you, we strive to have, when our dogs finish and they come over the finish line, unless you see the huskies, they have this automatic smile. It's daft, but the dogs smile, and to see happy, healthy huskies coming over a line, they don't know if they've come first or last, or that as long as they've enjoyed themselves on that race, nothing has happened out there, and they've got back safe and sound, is what they enjoy. And literally, our dogs especially, as many others, 5 minutes after they've had their rehydration drink and they've settled down, they want to go again. And that's the hardest part, in telling them that, no, you've done your race, you're not going again, that's it for today.
Okay. And do you, if you don't win, do you blame yourself or do you blame the dogs?
Never, ever, ever blame the dogs. It's always yourself. I mean, things can happen out on the trail. I mean, we get wildlife incidents where I've been out with the team and we have the friendly deer and the dog doesn't want to go the way you want it to go. It will chase the deer. They're lives, they're animals at the end of the day. They will do things like that. Or unfortunately, you may get a puncture or something like that. But it's never, ever the dog's fault. Never.
Brilliant. I've just loved talking to you. I think it's just been such... it's so refreshing. No, it's been lovely, and I've loved hearing about the dogs, because who knew that here you are framing pictures, having all your Hollywood display, and in your downtime you're racing dogs. I mean, this is just amazing. What do you wear when you race dogs, incidentally?
What do you wear? Your scruffiest clothes possible. No, obviously, because it's winter, we wear lycra leggings and lycra top, but not everywhere is that. Somebody wear coats and things like that as well. But again, we have to be athletes, as the dogs are, so we have been known to get off and do a bit of running as well. So yeah, appropriate clothing and good footwear.
I want to see you in the Vivian Westwood. Actually, no, I want to see Martin in the Vivian Westwood speedo, fake fur speedo. So get them out of that frame. It's been a joy talking to you, Sharon. And listeners, please come and see the new Rembrandt Gallery on Scarrett's Lane in Newport, because I think it just fills your heart with joy, and you might just get the one perfect present for Christmas. I'm sure you will. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye now. www.factusradio.com